Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I hope you've enjoyed the first segment of this interview with Brent Winters. This next segment, we're going to be getting more into the weeds. And so in the next segment after this, we're actually going to, because the challenge I have for Mr. Winters, or Brent, is really trying to create like a step or a checklist, you know, restoring our common law system by numbers, kind of like painting by numbers or what have you. Because distilling information down to those types of things is really what helps people kind of get their arms around, understand, comprehend what needs to be done so that we can work together. So that's what we're going to be getting to, not in this segment. Gave you a real good overview. This next segment is going to actually talk about some more details. We're actually going to even talk about the purpose of a grand jury. And I kind of was feeding him, what do you do when you've got a sheriff that's out of control? What do you do when you got a sheriff that's actually going after people that are supporting the Constitution? It's almost like the sheriff is acting like McCarthy, except instead of supporting the Constitution, the sheriff is just, I'll use the term going rogue regarding the, you know, help me out here, going rogue. It's like McCarthyism. Instead of supporting the Constitution, he's just, it's a communist going after people that are real patriots. And this is just hard for me to fathom. So anyway, as you know, this show was also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And this still is the only show that gives you the academic evidence-based solutions as well as we give you the macro view with an academic picture. Let me ask you once again, are you a part of the problem or a part of the solution? Getting involved, and if you haven't recognized with the high potential of martial law and the draconian acts that are being inflicted upon your civil liberties, it's time. You've got to get involved, because if this isn't the time where they truly push us over the edge, this is just the... This is the precursor. This is like the introduction to what they're planning on doing in melting us down and failing. I will say this, and I'm going to talk about this next time. Actually, I will talk about it when we come back from the break after this segment. So at the very end, I will plug this concept of who should really be paying for our economic toils and how to do this. But anyway, we'll be right back after this promo with Brent Alan Winters. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again,
Don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, folks, we are back with Mr. Winters, Brent Winters. Do you go by Esquire as well, or do you...
I do go, a lot of times, I go by Brent Allen Winters, because I've seen it eliminate some confusion, being so many Brent Winters is around on the media. So, Brent Allen Winters, but I'll go by anything that people call me, as long as I recognize it's me, so that's not a problem. My mother did give me that name. I hadn't used it most of my life. In the last 20 years or so, I've started using it, and I kind of like it. Why have a name and just leave it left alone and never say it all your life, I guess, is what I'm thinking. Go ahead.
Right, so I kind of made, I don't want to say an out of turn or a backhanded reference to the bar, referring to Esquire, because I think I know your feeling on the bar, but I know my audience doesn't. I've never really talked much about the bar other than those associated, because most all of our problems, and you'll probably even agree with this, most all of our problems have come from dubious lawyers who have had machinations of seizing and channeling powers into things that serve them. And so, anyway, what are your feelings on the bar before we get back into common law?
Oh, that's an important subject. That's an important subject. What is a common lawyer? There are only two kind of lawyers in the world. There are common lawyers, and there are civil lawyers. And the civil lawyers are not that civil. The common lawyers are called, and historically have been called, commoners. Commoners. The common lawyers only exist in the English-speaking world, which only includes about five major countries. Canada, United States, New Zealand, Australia, and Britain. And there are smaller places like Belize, former colonies, where the common law exists, and they pursue it. But civilians is the name still of lawyers in the rest of the world. And when I say the rest of the world, I mean all of the rest of the world, with the apparent, and I say apparent, exception of the Islamic countries, but they're law of the city countries too. The law of the city takes on many different names, and that's the confusion of it. The law of the land, is just in those five countries. The law of the land, the lawyers are called common lawyers, commoners for short. That's the word. That's where the word commoner came from. Law of the land lawyers. All lawyers in the United States, I'd say most of them probably don't know it, because comparative law is by design not taught. Comparative law, that is the study of the law of the land versus the law of the city. It used to be a required course in all law schools. Then it went to a optional course, and now it doesn't exist hardly at all.
Right. So, but back to the bar, though, your feelings on the bar, I'm going to make a conclusion here. Your feelings on the bar is it is an entity of self-servance, and it seems like the bar is the one that's kind of culpable or responsible for inducing and kind of ramming civil law down our throats.
And this is what has happened. The lawyers, the common lawyers in America, with the exception of Louisiana, because that's the only law of the city jurisdiction among our states.
Right.
But the common lawyers of the United States have the chief responsibility of preserving our common law. Just as the clergymen of America, the Christian clergymen, their chief responsibility is to preserve. That means do not add to, do not take away from Deuteronomy chapter 4, from the Bible, and to teach it. But they don't do it. They are chiefly responsible for the anemic and effeminate nature of Christianity. Anemic and effeminate. And I repeat myself when I say that. And that there's a whole understanding of the Bible that goes behind that too.
Right.
Well, that's where we are. And the confusion of the sexes has now come to overtake us. That didn't just happen out of happenstance. That happened because of God's people, and more importantly, those charged with teaching God's people, accepting money and taking positions where they're supposed to teach the law of our Maker. How can we have decency without the law of our maker? We can't. It's not possible. They don't teach that. The lawyers are the chief preservers, supposed to be. They accept the responsibility of preserving our common law. They don't even know, don't have a clue what the common law is. I know I asked men in high positions. I've asked men in high positions of Supreme Court justices of our state. I've had opportunities to interview them on different occasions on the radio and other high-placed lawyers. They don't know the difference. Why don't they know the difference? Because they're not taught the difference in the law schools. Well, why aren't they taught it in the law schools? Because the useful idiots of the evil empire know that the evil empire, if they don't destroy the distinction between the law of evil, and I'm quoting John Wycliffe when I say that, evil men's law. What did he call evil men's law? The law of the city. By the way, that includes, that's the Code of Justinian, the law of the Roman Empire. That includes the canon law of the Church of Rome. The canon law of the Church of Rome and of the Eastern Orthodox Church is the Code of Justinian put to an ecclesiastic purpose. It's also the law of the country, for instance, of Ethiopia. As far as I know, that's the only country that has the strict canon law for its law, but it's no different than the Code of Justinian in fundamental principle. As a matter of fact, throughout the world, and even yet today in some places, if you study the law of the city, you'll do it at a university. All universities are the product of Rome, beginning in the year 1053 with the founding of the university at the city of Bologna in Italy at the behest of the Pope of Rome. But if you go to South America, if you get a degree in Justinian's law, it will be called a dual degree, studying both the canon and the civil laws. And they have a special Latin word for that, but it's a degree in the canon civil laws, it's canon civil hyphenated, because they're the same law.
Okay, that, so let me, if I could just, yeah, if just inject, because you make a point regarding the clergy, and there's this issue as well regarding the bar and the law. What I believe had to happen is, and I believe that the Second Awakening in America was the genesis of the turning from the fundamental Christianity. And when I say fundamental Christianity, in America, and my listeners know that the Catholic Church did not have control. There were not a lot of Catholics, and as a matter of fact, a lot of Catholics were persecuted, such as when the Irish came and so forth, who were still kind of clinging to the Catholic Church. But bottom line, the Second Awakening created evangelicalism, which moved away from having a physical church to a wandering church. And I throw it out so people understand that this was the beginning of Christianity moving from I'll call it a layman's church, where the clergy actually had professions. John Adams' father, who was a clergyman, was a cobbler, and he supported his family on that profession. And his layman's responsibility, or his responsibility as a clergy, was in service of the people. And what happened in the early 1800s is this is where the Christianity took on the same perversion of the Church of Rome, where all of a sudden it was a profession for them. This is how they made their money. And so the evangelical troops, they would literally go into communities, take the money and leave. And what would happen when hard times befell upon either a parishioner, member, or a person in that town, the money that they gave is now gone. So there's no supplication from the clergy. There's no community or compassionate services availed to them. And so what ended up happening, this is why the clergy went to President Jackson at the time, when they had a downturn in the economy, they pleaded that the government create jobs, because bottom line, the clergy couldn't afford to feed their family and take care of their flock. And so this paradigm shift had started occurring. And that was the beginning of turning over to the government this concept of being able to create secularism of godlessness. Secularism in the framers' context was non-denominational. Now, when the federal government started getting involved in compassionate services with education, healthcare, and those types of things, mid-1800s, that's where we started seeing the tone of godlessness come along. The same thing on the law side. I believe that the bar quickly started recognizing, and that's why we had the original 13th Amendment and this disdain for these titles of nobility and emoluments and so forth, and trying to constrain that, because lawyers were beginning to prop themselves up as the bastion of power within our society. And so the bar and the clergy seem to have taken down this path of embracing what I would just call, you know, perversions against basically Christianity, common law, and so forth. Anyway, forgive me for interjecting that.
You draw two things together that are worthy commenting on, and I want to try to get to your point that you tried to get me on in the beginning.
Right.
So many things to talk about. Let's start with this. I'll say it up front. Esquire. Is that a title of nobility? And the answer is categorically, no, it is not. What is a title of nobility? A title of nobility is hereditary. It comes by blood. Esquire may be inappropriate. You may argue that. But it's in the category of Mr., Mrs., Miss, which we've used for centuries. When I was a boy, I used to get things in the mail. It'd say Master, M-A-S-T-E-R, Brent Allen Winters. I was taught as a boy to address letters to males under the age of majority as Master. Boy, have things changed. I don't think anybody's ever heard of that now. And I was told that it was, when it was a man over the age of majority, to me it was Mr., even after I grew up. Mr., Master. Well, those are not hereditary titles. Those are titles of respect, titles that identify a man. I mean, Esquire is different. Esquire is not like the Roman title of degree. Romanism and Babylonianism always includes degrees. Master's degree, doctor's degree, LLD degree, degree. Masonry, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 33rd degree. The secret Gnostic religions have degrees of levels of learning, and that's intended to cow people. That's what that's all about. Esquire is not one of those kind of terms. The lawyers in England, when the common lawyers first came on the scene, they did it in opposition to the Roman civil law that was engulfing their courts, and Roman priests were being appointed from France and other places to judgeships, and only Norman French was spoken in the courts. So they said, we've got to do something to preserve our Anglo-Saxon way of life and our Anglo-Saxon law. Well, how did that happen? It came up with men that could speak both tongues, because the only tongue spoken after the Norman invasion in the courts and in the legislature and in the courts of the king, the executive branch, was Norman French, a bastardized form of Norman French. We still have a lot of those words in our legal tradition. The word petition, for instance, petition is a French word, but now it's become part of our English language through our legal tradition. It's even in our Constitution of the United States. It's a common law word. All of the common law after 1066 became wound up and increasingly bound up in Norman French words. Well, that's how common lawyers arose, because if you were an Anglo-Saxon or a Dane, or what they called in those days, an Anglo-Dane, and you had a problem and tried to get into the courts, you could not represent yourself because you couldn't speak Norman French. So a class of men arose that could speak both tongues, and they would help the widow or the child and speak for them in the courts. But then they begin to see, we have a little power here. We have the common law, because it was the habit of the Normans when they conquered a place, like William the Conqueror conquered England. His brother conquered Sicily. In both of those cases, Roger II, they said whatever laws in place, were keeping it. That's the way they conquered. They never infused their own law, whatever they thought it might be. But what William the Conqueror, William the First, we call him, Rufus, he was a red-headed fellow. They called him Rufus. That's Latin for red. What he did do was he added to our common law increased precision of administration, which is part of the Roman tradition. Romanism, Babylonianism, was all about precision. Case in point, the English measurement system, the metric measurement system, which arose out of France during the Revolution. In the Roman, the Babylonian system of law, everything is precise, everything is like an equation, everything has elegance, it has beauty. and it's just cut and dried. That's not the way it is at common law. Common law appears messy. Well, the jury doesn't even know the law. They just know what's right and wrong. That's why we ask them what they ask them. We ask them to give their verdict. We don't want the experts. It's not a law of experts. It's a law of the people. Who's the people? The militia. And there are two duties of the militia, common defense, armed defense, and serving on the jury. And so the oath we have in our Constitution of the United States, again, our common law infuses an understanding into our Constitution. And if you don't understand this, you don't understand the oath that every office holder in the United States, federal and state, is required to take. It is to defend. It is to defend, again, our law of the land. What's our law of the land? Our Constitution, which is our common law. To defend the law of the land against all enemies, foreign. That's armed defense. That's the first duty of the militia. And domestic. That's the willingness to serve on the jury. Well, when you serve on the jury, you're defending the law of the land. That's defending the land. When you're taking up arms, you're defending the land. That's defending the land. It all comes back to the land. But the term esquire, to get back on point, is not a title of nobility because it's not hereditary. But it is a title that is in contradistinction to the degrees of the people coming out of the universities. You see, the lawyers, the common lawyers that arose at that time that knew both languages and were trying to help people, they formed their own institutions of learning. Because the universities would not let them in. Why wouldn't they let them in? Because the universities are established for the distinct and declared purpose of supplanting the Bible with the Code of Justinian as the final rule of life. And it still is with the Roman Church. The canon law is the final rule, not the Bible. Everything else mixed in, and the Pope's word, ex cathedra, is the final rule. That's what the Code of Justinian says, is what the emperor says, the will of the prince, as John Calvin used to say and teach. He never got away from that. The will of the prince is law. Well, we don't say that in America. No, we're a common law country. We don't say the will of the prince is law. We say that we are a country of laws and not men. That's just the opposite.
Okay. So,
and you said a while ago, we take an oath to a set of first principles, which are common law principles, called at this point, the Constitution of the United States, the law of the land. Back to you.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I do know that the title sheriff was a title of nobility in England. And the title sheriff was also brought into America as a public servant, but it wasn't a title of nobility in America. In England, if you were of a noble birth, noble family, and there was no positions for you, then you would become the sheriff, and you would be basically the tax collector and the kind of the controller of the minions. And
That's an important point, but let me make a distinction, if I may.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Before the Norman invasion, the title of shire reeve, that means agent of the shire. What's the shire? When the Normans prince came there, they called it the county, and there was a count who was a chief man. So they brought the language of Rome, the imprint of Rome, to England. The shire reeve, before the Norman invasion of 1066, was the sheriff. We call him the sheriff. But he wasn't. That was not an hereditary title. William Blackstone makes that clear. It was an elected position, just like it is in America. America was an attempt. James Wilson, on the first panel of our Supreme Court, an immigrant from Scotland, he made the point. He said, no. He said, our Constitution of the United States and the constitutions of the states are our attempt to bring us back behind Magna Carta, to establish the common laws that existed and stood before Magna Carta. Magna Carta was an attempt to do the same thing. So the sheriff in America is elected, and it's not hereditary. But after, you see, and it was, his responsibility was to the people, the militia, the people of the county, of the shire at that time.
So
after the Norman invasion, that changed. You're right. I mean, that was wrong. Go ahead.
Right. So the sheriff in America, is he the commander of the militia? Is he supposed to be the commander of the county's militia?
He is in this sense, but to make another distinction, this is the common law, confusion of terms. The common law appears messy until you begin to get a feel for it. But the sheriff in what we call the county, which is traditionally 36 townships, is the man that has authority to summon, muster the posse. The posse. What is the posse? That's short for posse comitatus. if you remember the old Westerns, they
summon
a posse. Well, that's posse comitatus. That's a Latin term. Again, it comes out of the Latin-based stuff that came out of perhaps the Norman invasion. Before that, they didn't know Latin. They called it Anglo-Saxon, the Fyrd, F-Y-R-D. F-Y-R-D. That's an old Anglo. That's an old Germanic word. It means militia. And the Fyrd Fair was the militia mustered, or the, we would say in common military parlance, the militia mobilized. To them, Fyrd Fair, we still use the word fair, it means a-goin', the militia a-goin', mustered, armed, a-goin'. Well, the militia, back to the county, the mustering of the militia within the county, and the county sheriff has that authority, we call, to distinguish it, the posse. But you take all those posses together, really they are subsets, yes, at a common law, they are subsets of the militia. And in our common law tradition, as applied in America, our Constitution has four militia clauses. They're all ignored, have been for 175 years. We need to get them back up online. But the militia is of the several states. That's the way our Constitution puts it. Of the several sovereign states. Several, that means individual militias of the states. And the governor of each state has concurrent, that means authority at the same time, with the president of the United States to call out the old Anglo-Saxon Fyrd or the posse, any part of it or all of it, and whoever calls it out first has jurisdiction. That's why we call it concurrent jurisdiction. And the governors need to understand that, do they? They don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. They're not taught it. Nobody tells them. That's how much they know about the common law that informs our Constitution. Again, why is the Constitution boring to people? Why don't people read it? It's because the infusion of our common law is the gumption breath, the spirit of our common law, breathes life into the document, and the blown bladder, otherwise blown bladder of our Constitution, that dry and dispirited skeleton of words scattered about or in a pile, is meaningless. It's dry. But once the common law comes, it stands up, it inflates it, it makes it sturge, and it walks, and it has usefulness. That's why we're coming at the Constitution. We say the Constitution, and we want to say we need to go know the Constitution. That's not it. Knowing the Constitution, to approach it like it's the Code of Justinian of the civilian, of the law of the city world, to come at it like that, by the way, Justice Scalia did that because he was a Romanist. And I'm not against Justice Scalia. He did a lot of good things. But at that point, he didn't get it because he was trained in his heart of hearts to come at the Constitution and parse the words like the Code of Justinian and the tradition of the law of the city demands. There has to be an infusion. Now, in the Heller decision, for instance, back in 2009, Justice Scalia did a good job of infusing the Second Amendment with the common law.
Right.
He did that.
Yeah.
Justice Scalia is on my side. I don't want to make that unclear. But there was an element of Justice Scalia, an interpretation of writings of legal significance, such as the Constitution. He applied that interpretation across the board, although he was schizophrenic about it. He was a common lawyer. Go ahead.
I'll say he was actually evolutionary. He evolved when he became a justice, because at the very beginning of his term as a justice, a chief justice, or actually not chief justice, but a member of this court, the Supreme Court, he was in favor of the amendment of the amendment process of fixing the problems of government. And then I think it was took him time to realize that the amendment process is really to fix a deficiency with the Constitution, not to fix problems with the government because of noncompliance. And so that's why he actually, you know, flip-flopped from being in favor of the Constitution to then not being in favor. But what I want to focus back on is this concept of common law and the sheriff, because it seems to me, and as a matter of fact, the Constitution's really clear regarding the calling up of the militia in Article 4, Section 4, because to be clear, the militia by the federal government can only be called up by Congress. It's the same thing as the declaring war powers. And then when they call them up, then the president steps in as the chief executive. And that's the same thing at the state level, because in Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, it says if there is a rise or a, you know, imminent danger or emergency, the state legislatures are to call up the militia, you know, before it, and make an appeal to them. But if they're not in session, then the governor has the power then to call up the militia. So to, you know, to kind of keep things in the perspective of how what the framers and our government, our sovereigns, and they refer to our sovereigns as our legislators. And they don't mean them as the ultimate sovereigns or full sovereigns. These are the men that we've delegated very specific powers to govern us with. We created an enumerated delegation of power instead of general powers, because they understood, and they argued this throughout the ratification debates, that general powers lead to tyranny and despotism. But by creating very defined enumerated powers, well, this is all they can do. And so once we've now created these powers to government, once they start going beyond that, then we, you know, we have to challenge their jurisdiction, their authority, and so forth in matters that they have no power over. But those have all, we've all been dumbed down, and we've been convinced that our governments have general powers when they actually don't. And we have to hold them accountable to the enumerated powers. But anyway, back to the sheriff. So the sheriff then, in essence, is the commander at the local level for enforcement of law. In other words, to ensure that there's no public civil unrest or insurrections, and or if you're on a bordering county of a foreign land, like in California, Texas, and so forth, you would have the responsibility of guarding that border from an invasion.
Oh, no question. And if the governor doesn't act, the sheriff has responsibility to act. And we find that in recent cases. There was a case in 1968, the city of Baltimore, I believe it was, during the pervasive race riots throughout the country, burning cities down. That happened, destruction of property. And property owners in Baltimore sued the city and said, "We want our money back." Why? "Well, you didn't do your duty." "Well, what do you mean we didn't do our duty? You should have mustered the posse comitatus. The police force didn't do it. You had the power to do that, and you didn't do it." And the courts agreed and said, "Yeah, you had that power, and you didn't do it. And right. Therefore, you must pay damages to these property owners."
Right.
Well, the sheriff, go ahead.
Sorry. So one of the two objects, Madison and the other framers had always argued that the two objects, I think even Adam Smith argued this, the two objects of government is to protect life and to protect property. And if they're not doing that, and when they get into the realm of actually taking property from you to give to somebody else, then they're actually perverting their responsibilities. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is I want to focus really for what little time we have, and I know this isn't into the common law thing, but this is kind of segued into, I am seeing sheriffs who are actually violating their constitution because they're actually going after, and there is a problem now that we're seeing sheriffs who have become a part of, I'll just call it the Borg, or this globalist agenda, where they're going after, instead of focusing on enforcing the law, they're focusing on trying to target patriot organizations, constitutional supporters, and so forth, harassing them and you trying to make press against them and pointing to them as the enemy within and so forth. And I'm going, oh my gosh, we're now in a position where we're seeing McCarthyism completely reversed, where the communists are in power and they're calling out patriots for actually supporting the Constitution. And I what world
well,
are we in?
But no question, if somebody says you're a constitutionalist and there's not an officer or lawyer in the land that is not a constitutionalist by definition of law, having taken an oath, and then it's weird. I've had people call me a constitutional lawyer as though that's some kind of a different kind of an animal. Well, listen, here's the other thing I wanted to bring out, and I'm glad you brought this up. Of course it's a good subject. It's right down to the ground where the rubber meets the road right now.
Right.
Sheriffs, the Constitution doesn't say anything about sheriffs. So it's puzzled me why people say, "Well, he's a constitutional sheriff." Well, that's just empty talk. Really, the truth is, the Constitution doesn't have to say anything about sheriffs. Again, the Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. Well, what's the duty of the sheriff of common law? You see, the Constitution freights in all of that with its words and phrases. The sheriff has taken an oath to support the law of the land. Well, what's the law of the land? Article 6, the Constitution of the United States, and all that it freights in with that. And in that, it means that he has power in his county He has responsibility if the governor won't act. He's got to act to defend as much of his county and any other neighboring county he can, with the posse comitatus if it comes to that. And if he doesn't do that, he's liable. And he is to pay the damages, and he is the one that maybe has even, it depends on the circumstances, if he's aided the enemy. What's that? Well, that either be treason against his own state, and every state has standards for treason against the state, or treason against his own general government. To use that word and understood correctly, and you mentioned general a while ago, and I caught what you meant, but our founders and the people in the early part of our country called the government in Washington, D.C., the general government, and for good reason, understood right. In distinction, it should be called that today, in distinction to the state governments. But every person, here's our common law. Let's get honest. Let's be honest with history. Those men that ratified the Constitution did not have in their wildest imagination any thought of the female of the species being included in the militia of the several states. That wasn't even part of their understanding that any of them would ever run for office and that any of them would have jury duty. I remember my own lifetime when some states did not allow women on juries, namely New York, within my lifetime. I remember seeing that movie, at 12 Angry Men. Well, there were no women there. Why? The law didn't allow it. That's why. Well, I'm not making a statement one way or another about that, but I am making this statement as a matter of historic accuracy. Those men didn't have women in their minds at all about any of that. So when they said the Constitution of the United States and the militia of the several states, they were talking about men. And by the way, I want to throw this in. It's a deep conviction, and I am appalled that otherwise intelligent men go along with this. It is downright ugly, dirty, and godless and evil for men to say, it's all right for my daughters to go catch bullets and shrapnel and my wife, but I don't have to go, maybe. What kind of a world do we live in where we're putting up poster pictures of girls with their legs blown off to try to get other women to go face shrapnel and bullets? We're a sick, sick country, if that's our point of view. And I hear men promoting that point of view. I will not promote that point of view. Women have no business. And whose fault is it? It's the men's fault. They're the ones that are promoting it. Because the gals are patriotic, and they want to help, and they are faithful. And so why don't then the men then take that inclination of the female and they use it to take their place and face bullets and shrapnel and death? That ought to be enough to make any honest man's blood boil.
Right.
And it should not happen.
I agree.
But not to degrade the female. She's faithful and she will always. She's inclined to do whatever she can to help if the men will give her the green light.
Right.
And they've done it. And we're talking about military men, officers in that position, men serving under women and saying that's okay. It's not okay. That needs to stop, and it will be our downfall. It is the badge of our evil that we're doing that. Our military services and our militia exist so she can do her job, which is not our job. There's a big difference. Well, the important thing about the history of it that I'm trying to bring out is they didn't have that in their minds. What they had was men doing the two duties of the people of the United States. And in their minds, the people are the militia. Go read even the Old Testament. You see the word people, the people, ha'am in the Hebrew, my people, ami. Always, always, always that Hebrew phrase refers to a band of armed men. And in almost most all cases, to the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel. That's what it refers to. You get to the New Testament, you see the same thing. My people who are called by my name, if they will humble themselves and pray,
so
and the land will be healed. If all the females in America fell down on their faces before God and prayed, that wouldn't make the difference. Why? Because they're not the problem. That's why. Who's the problem? Just like in the Garden of Eden, who was the problem? Was it Eve, our grandma? No. Paul makes it clear it was Adam. And what plunged the race into depravity was Adam when he partook, not Eve. And then he explains why that's true. Back to you.
Okay, so I wanted to, because we only have about 6 minutes left, what I want to do is identify what a sheriff really should do, And what do you do when you have a sheriff that is actually going after people, calling them out for, you know, they're supporting the Constitution? What do you do about a sheriff that is actually created and or is waging, I'll just call it a personal war, against our constitutional rights? In other words, we don't have the freedom of expression. We don't have the freedom of assembly. As a matter of fact, we're even seeing that in a lot of the states, and the United States is going down this path of denying our First Amendment rights. And
that's
so,
right. We're doing it right now. Right now with this shutdown,
yes.
They're saying, well, we don't want churches to get together. Well, that's a violation of freedom of association.
And assembly.
We don't want... And assembly.
Yes.
And a speech.
Yes. And expression.
On we go. No, this is massive.
It is.
But here's what we should do. Here's what we should do. Brent, me, right here, right now, government, the problem's not in the White House, it's not in your state house, it's not in the county courthouse, it's in your house, because you violate government right where you are. We must seek to establish God's order in our family. How does that begin? Go back to the Garden of Eden. That's where government begins, the order between the man and the woman. And where do you fit in that? Well, I'm not married, I'm a widow, or I'm husbandless, or I'm fatherless. The Bible speaks to all that in certain and precise terms. We must learn what government is. We must practice it right here. And the common law is strengthened, as Blackstone points out. Our common law is a law about every man discerning his duty before God in defiance, if he has to, of everyone else. How do you know when to do that? Let me throw this out quickly, a first principle of our common law. You obey the government, you obey the sheriff, you obey those in authority, in those positions of potential authority, you obey them as long as that obedience does not constitute direct or disobedience to God. Case in point, should you stop at a stop sign? Yes. Should you carry a load, as Jesus Christ points out in the Sermon on the Mount? Should you carry a load for a government official if he asks you to stop and help, if doing so is not a direct disobedience to God? Answer, yes. We do a lot of things government says to do that are maybe silly or stupid because it does not constitute direct disobedience to God. But where obedience to government constitutes direct disobedience to God, we must say no. We cannot control the sheriff of our county, but God has given me authority. He's given you authority. He's given every person authority and the duty to do right in every instance of their lives. That's our common law. Here's another principle of our common law that covers everything. No man, no woman, nobody has any right to do wrong. No person has a right to do wrong. Well, the legislature said to, says the judge. The jury says the judge instructed us. No, no, no. You can't cover yourself that way.
So,
that's what the Nazis said. That's what the Japanese said.
You,
go ahead.
You bring up a really good point. And so I've articulated, and I've been articulating, people call me a germaphobe or what have you, but I've actually had the opinion for a long time that if you know you have the flu, because the flu actually kills people, if you know you have the flu and you go out in public, you go to work, you go to the store, the only place that a person that has the flu or has is exhibiting a viral infection of some kind, then the only place that you really should be going is to the doctor for seeking treatment and or assistance or what have you, if you need that. The only other place you should be is at home resting so that you're not actually exposing, because I consider exposing people to a viral infection is tantamount to potential murder, because you could actually transfer that to one person that could transfer it to somebody else that actually leads to murder. And so, or I should say death. And even though it may not be an act, a direct act, it is still a callousness towards your fellow man that you're putting them in harm's way. And this concept of restricting all people and forcing them to stay in their home is tyrannical. I do believe that we're at a level of enlightenment that we understand the flu, that it's not something that is, you know, is within us, that we have to bleed out like in the old days. We understand how it is commuted and so forth. And understanding that, we should have, I will call it proactive law, to say if you are sick and you have a flu then or a viral infection, then you need to stay home. You need to self-quarantine. And if you're caught going to work and get turned in, then you should be fine. Just like you're driving a car with bald tires, you should be fine for actually driving in an unsafe manner. If you cause an accident by driving with bald tires, you could be found in negligence and possible, you know, negligent homicide or what have you, whatever, you know, the outcome of that is. And it should be the same thing with somebody that is carrying a viral infection. Your point or your perspective on this.
I agree with what you said in principle, and I would add this. I do add this. The Bible speaks specifically to that point. If someone has a particular disease, they're quarantined, and the Bible goes into detail about that. These are the first principles that we should pay attention to. But to have government step in and do what it does, as it is now doing, and then threaten people for violation of that, is a sign, the badge, that we are lawless and judgment is upon us.
So what
that's
do you,
what that's a sign of. So tyranny is judgment.
Absolutely. So what do you do with the sheriff or any law enforcement that says, I'm going to support these tyrannical laws, these governor and state legislator edicts that are basically violating your individual rights? What do you do?
What do you do? Here's the bottom line. Of course, you can vote them out of office. You can campaign against them. But in all events, and this is where it comes down to personal discernment, in all events, you do not obey your obedience directly, clearly, unambiguously, and you better make sure you're right. If there's any question, don't do it. Unambiguously requires your obedience to the government is disobedience to a clear, unambiguous statement of God.
Right.
The will of God. The will of the sovereign is law. If it's God, that's true. And that's what God has revealed to us, his will. And he wants a people who obey him. And there's great blessing in it. And you trust God. You trust him when you obey him. You have to, because you're facing the evil empire and the useful idiots of it. And if you're a sheriff or a sheriff's deputy, and I've met some of you that think that we obedient, that the Americans owe obedience to you, and we are required to talk to you and violate in the violation of the fifth commandment, you're wrong. And you need to take an inventory of who you are and who you took an, or what you took an oath to. But listen, when you take an oath to support the law of the land, which is what our Constitution calls itself, that's an oath to the will of God. The will of God. And you're spitting in God's face. And you're going to pay a horrible price.
Okay.
I hope you're listening. I hope those folks, not you.
No.
They have those responsibilities.
Sure, absolutely. And I agree. And what I have to inform you, though, is we're out of time again. So, folks, we're going to have to call it an end. But what we need to do, Mr. Winters, is understand, one, how we moved away, how we evolved into the civil law, and the process of restoring common law into the legal system. And I know I've talked about this before, but I don't want to kind of lend into that at this point. I really need to get going. We're going to be running out of time, and I have to encapsulate these things within my time allowed on the radio. So with that, I want to invite you back, and we'll try to schedule that in the near future. But I really appreciate your time, and there's probably nothing more important than understanding this aspect as well as all the other aspects that we have to understand regarding the complete perversion of our laws, our land, and so forth. So, again, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And again, I promise we will have you back on soon, and I will work with you regarding, you know, that schedule and getting availing your time, because I think that's the conversation we have to have. We have to talk about, you know, the cause of how we got to where we are and the solution of getting and restoring these things. And I think you'll agree with me.
Certainly I do.
Absolutely.
I look forward to it.
All right. Well, folks, we will be right back after these promos. And so please stay tuned, and I'll be able to give you a summary regarding these conversations and future conversations. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, as we were just talking about, I wanted to kind of tie together this whole concept of, you know, sheriffs violating the Constitution, as well as all the other public servants. To be truthful, there is definitely something wrong when you have a sheriff that is going running around acting like McCarthy, except instead of acting like McCarthy in support of the Constitution and trying to root out communism and its threat, the greatest threat that we face is communism. We're being surrounded by it, and we have a sheriff, and he's probably not the only one, but there are sheriffs and any other public servant that is supporting this concept of social justice, supporting the concept of people who support the Constitution are our threat. Are you kidding? So, we'll be diving into that in more detail. We ran out of time. And plus, as I said, I want to get it to where we can provide you with like a painting by numbers, or, you know, here is the list of, you know, you got to do this, then this, then this. What has to be done serially, you know, in other words, first, second, third, fourth, and what we can do in parallel. But obviously, one of the things that we can do in parallel, and that's what I'm working with in NLA with, is getting Republic Review moving forward. And they're supporting that education and getting people engaged. With that, the one thing, and I'm going to talk more about this in our next episode, the one thing that I believe we should be doing is we should actually be actualizing what the magnitude of cost is for this government shutdown. And this should have been done by the states, but and it shouldn't have been so draconian. But nevertheless, we need to go after the debt that we owe China and basically cancel out all the debt that would, in other words, that's how we're going to pay for this. Because bottom line, China had the responsibility of doing no harm to those who they deal with in commerce and so forth. However, because they have a military attitude, that's why we've been hurt. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of of the solution.